Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. Begin with Michael Cohen, who is covering the Republican Convention in Tampa for the UK Guardian and The Observer. We will discuss last night's speech by Paul Ryan that has fact-checkers working overtime, and we will preview Mitt Romney's big speech tonight that will be boosted by an appearance by Clint Eastwood. Then we will speak with Tom Rosensteel, the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, about the role of the press in reporting apparent lies and distortions, and the subsequent role of fact-checkers in correcting the record. We will discuss the aftermath of the Paul Ryan speech and the extent to which the original lie carries more weight than follow-up efforts to refute the lies. Then finally, we will discuss the record-breaking $6 billion 2012 election with Michael Franz, the co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads in top races across the country. His books include Campaign Advertising and American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation, who is currently covering the Republican National Convention in Tampa for the UK Guardian and The Observer. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And in terms of your book, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America, do you think Mitt Romney's going to be on your list?
Well, I've read the excerpt so far, and I don't think at this point he's going to make the list. Looks a little platitudinous this evening.
So, what do you from reading his speech? What's the takeaway?
Excuse me, I just seen the excerpt, but it does seem to be basically his sort of general take that he's had on Obama, that Obama was not up for the job, that he hasn't fulfilled his promise. They let Americans down, and that Romney will be a better choice. What is missing in the excerpts, and I'm curious if you'll hear it tonight, is any kind of sense of what that means for a Romney presidency. I mean, I think the big issue for Romney is he needs to give some sense of how, not just that he's not Obama, right, that he's different from Obama, but how he would be better and how he has a plan to get the economy moving. And I haven't seen it yet. Maybe we'll see it when the speech is delivered later this evening.
Well, supposedly, just before he speaks, Marco Rubio is supposed to introduce Mitt Romney. But then there's this talk now that just before Marco Rubio, Clint Eastwood is going to show up and make their day,
yeah.
I guess.
I find that sort of fascinating. I mean, I guess they want to, make Romney look tougher by having Eastwood on stage, or they want to harken back to those, ads in the Super Bowl where he was talking about it being halftime in America. Eastwood's fine. Doesn't seem like a terribly, a seismic choice for a primetime speaker, but, maybe he'll appeal to a certain demographic. I mean, keep in mind, the Romney campaign is definitely focusing on older Americans, so maybe that's part of the idea in having Eastwood come out there.
You mean appealing to the Florida vote? Is that...
Well, I mean, sure, they have been playing, their base of support is really older Americans. So maybe having, an octogenarian like Eastwood come out will appeal to them in some way.
Well, apparently Eastwood's met with them fairly, with both of them, both Ryan and Romney. And he voted for Obama last time. And apparently they've convinced him that they're the ticket, and my understanding from these conversations is that Romney said that they'd get out of Afghanistan the first day in office, that not one American soldier should die for a lost cause. That, of course, is not what they're advertising at the moment.
No, not at all, and actually that's very surprising if they actually said that. I mean, one thing I noticed Afghanistan is an interesting example of what the Romney campaign has sort of become. They criticize the president, but if you look at the specifics of what they're recommending, it's a little hard to figure it out, but it basically is a continuation of Obama's policies. And in general, on foreign policy, this has sort of been the overall theme. They've been very critical of Obama, but when you get down to brass tacks and what they're actually recommending, it's not a lot of difference, frankly.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation, and he's currently covering the Republican National Convention in Tampa for the UK Guardian and The Observer, and he's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. So the speech last night by the Vice President nominee, Paul Ryan, certainly got the fact-checkers working overtime. What's your sense? We're going to be speaking with Tom Rosenstiel in a little while about the dynamic of getting the word out first, and how much that trumps the ability for the fact checkers following up, and whether you know the initial impression is more powerful than the. In other words, the emotional impact is greater than the intellectual follow-up, if you will. What was your sense of that speech, and were you struck by the stretching the truth or?
I tell you, I've read a lot of political speeches in my life, and I've listened to a lot of them. That was the most Ryan's speech was the most breathtakingly dishonest political speech I think I've ever heard. I mean, I was really sort of blown away by it. There were statements that were made that were clearly false, that were clearly misleading. One thing I'll say that's positive, and I'm curious what Tom has to say about this, but the initial reaction to the speech was very positive. The crowd was very excited. You know, it was delivered well. But the day has gone on, I certainly have noticed that there's been a real turn, as reporters have sort of said, you know what, there wasn't, as you put it, a casual relation with the truth to a lot of these things that he was saying. You can't blame Barack Obama for a GM plant that closes in your district before he was president. You know, you can't do that. And I think, in some respects, you know, this campaign, I've been shocked by the extent to which both Romney and Ryan have simply just been lying. I'll be very honest with you. They've been lying about Obama's record. And I think I'm wondering if after last night and this brazen mendacity that maybe this has caught up with them, and reporters have said enough is enough. We need to hold these guys' feet to the fire.
Well, but it obviously says something even more disturbing, and that is that these are deeply cynical people.
They are. I mean, I agree with you 100%. If you're going to give a speech like that, statements that you know are false. I mean, for example, just one example, on the debt commission, he blamed Obama for not embracing the debt commission. Ryan served him at that commission. He voted against its recommendations. To then put that on Obama is ludicrous, and he has to know, obviously, that he is being cynical by saying it. I'm sort of amazed at the cynicism of this, but, you know, it's not just Romney and Ryan. If you listen to the first night of the convention before prime time, you know, from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock, it was basically this every speaker, one after the other, you know, riffing off of Obama's "You didn't build that" line, which, of course, is also a lie. It's also just the whole party has been infected by this cynicism and this alternate reality that they've created. It's disturbing to me. And I say that, you know, as somebody who sort of... Has a sort of celebrates the political process, to see it being sort of debased by this sort of false discourse.
So, what's your sense then of this the big lie as a tactic? Do you think you're suggesting that maybe the press have just had enough and they're going to start calling them on the lies, or on the other hand? You know, I mean, I imagine it's difficult for the TV people after seeing all those people cheering and whooping, and the extent to which Ryan is the sort of wonder boy that's got them all whipped up and excited, to pour cold water on it. I mean, we don't have any Walter Cronkites anymore that people trust. So it's down to his word against the other person's word, and that you tend to dismiss it all. At least that's what I think happens with most American voters. They put it all down to, oh, this is just politics. There's no level of outrage. There's no way to appeal to people's conscience, saying that there's a difference between a political speech and an outright lie.
I mean, I think that's obviously the big fear, and I certainly, it concerns me as well, but I think, to be very honest, I have maybe a little more confidence that if people keep reminding, voters and reminding, people who watch the news that this is actually not true, that this is that these candidates are making things up, that it will eventually, it'll have an impact. And I think it does after a while. I mean, I don't think you can do this kind of prevarication and not pay some kind of political price for it. I mean, I think, here's what I think is interesting for what it's worth. I think this whole strategy suggests to me is that the Romney people believe they can't really appeal too well to independents or to undecided voters, that they need to mobilize their base. And the fact is that a lot of this rhetoric, the people who are supportive of Romney and who don't like Obama, they don't, fact-checking is, they are impervious to fact-checking. It just sort of bounces off of them. And so they hear this and it makes them more energized to go vote. But I think what Romney's strategy is in many respects, and it's becoming more obvious, is that he wants to, get those voters who are, don't like Obama and who are basically conservative, to vote for him and to come out in big numbers on Election Day. I don't think it's a winning strategy. I think the demographics, don't support the strategy. It does appear to be what they're trying to do. And I think, I don't think that you can do this kind of a lying, frankly. I'll just use the word again because that's what it is, lying, and really appeal to undecided independent voters. I think eventually it comes back against you and boomerangs against you.
Well, Michael Cohen, do you think, again, he's in Tampa, Florida, covering the Republican National Convention for the UK Guardian and The Observer, and the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. So given that that it's easy to sort of dismiss a lot of what politicians say because of the low esteem and the expectation that it's just politics and they all lie. But I guess in this case, if you have a team that the Romney-Ryan team that are so lie with such alacrity and are so deeply cynical, would it be then incumbent upon Obama to call them out? I mean, one of the things that it would seem that Romney is trying to run on, and I think that the fact that he has a lot of Mormons, particularly a bishop that succeeded him as stake president in Massachusetts on introducing him tonight, would indicate that he is trying to, the word they use is humanize himself, but I think he's also trying to show that he has a moral foundation. And, it's one of the Ten Commandments, bearing false witness. I just don't get it. I don't understand how you can pose yourself as a moral, generous guy who tithes and helps the needy within your church, and yet break one of the Ten Commandments with such frequency and alacrity.
Well, again, if your approach is to mobilize your core base of voters, it's a strategy that has the potential to succeed. Look, and let's be honest. I mean, politicians, stretch the truth all the time. They mislead and they deceive, and this is part of the political process. I think it's different to have such out and out, mistruths like you're seeing from these guys. But I think that I think they probably view this as very much at pace with how the political process works. I mean, maybe they're pushing the boundaries a little bit further. But again, I think this is targeting a very clear segment of the population that supports Romney, that is more conservative, that is likely to come out and vote. Whether it works, we'll see on Election Day. But I think that if you view it from that standpoint, from the strategy of their base mobilization, there is some rhyme and reason to what they're doing. But as you say, I mean, it is. You do wonder how much can you move away from those voters? How much can you bring in from sort of undecided independent voters if you're acting in a way that is not so not so honest?
So is it possible then the idea that you can do basically you're prepared to do anything to win if indeed you're lying. And you're being deeply cynical, but you figure this is what you have to do to win. I'm curious to get an understanding, and here is the candidate introducing himself to the American people tonight. I frankly don't have a take on what makes this man tick. It seems that he's driven by ambition without purpose.
Yeah, that's an interesting take, and I think that's right. And this is something that I find a bit confusing about the Romney strategy. A lot of times after you go through a difficult primary season, as Romney did, you want to find some way to present a positive image of yourself. You want to humanize your candidate. you want to, you know, run a lot of bio ads and make people think, you know, think that you're somebody they want to have a beer with, to coin a phrase. And I think one thing that happened in the summer is that the Romney campaign decided not to do that. They decided to basically attack Obama and not run positive ads. And the result was that the Obama people really defined them, defined Romney. And so a lot, you know, it's interesting, a lot of the negative perceptions of Romney, and he's a very unpopular candidate, you know, historically so, with unfair abilities higher than his favorabilities, you know, they have defined him in a negative way, and the Romney people haven't really been able to push back on that. I think you'll see some of it tonight, although reading the excerpt, I don't get a sense of somebody who's really trying to humanize himself. And having spent 2 days here in Tampa, I don't get a really a strong sense that they've done a very good job of you know, presenting Romney in a more positive light.
Well, the Reuters Ipsos poll on the favorability have Romney at 29% and Obama at 51%. So that's quite an uphill climb he's got.
Yeah, I mean, again, if you recognize, you know, he's not a very popular candidate, this again goes back to the strategy of trying to mobilize your base. I mean, you have a lot of these voters who aren't going to care. They don't like Romney. They don't like a lot more. And so they're more inclined to look past their personal views of Romney if it means they can get Obama out of office. And you have to recognize there's a good segment of the population that doesn't like Obama and that wants to see him, you know, not be reelected. And I think that's kind of what Romney's counting on. I think the problem with that strategy is it relies on having a really, you know, mobilizing your base very, very effectively, and Obama not mobilizing his base very effectively. Not sure that can work.
Well, it could also have the effect that the more you mobilize the kind of extreme Tea Party elements, that eventually that's going to wake up the somnambulant Obama voters who, you know, appear to be pretty dormant at this moment. I don't know when they're going to get their wake-up call.
Well, I think that's an interesting argument. And one example of that, I think, is what happened in Missouri with Todd Akin. I mean, you see, that was a real embarrassment for Romney, and I think something that really, really hurt his campaign because it raised the abortion issue and highlighted his vulnerabilities among women, which is a real problem for him because there's a real gender gap among female voters. So I think you're right. There is one risk of a sort of playing so much to the far right that you end up energizing people who really don't appeal to a broad cross-section of Americans.
Well, just in the last minute, Michael Cohen, are our calculations off in as much as we've always believed that the American center is ultimately what decides elections in this country? Has the center shrunk because of the polarization of the media and of politics to the point where it's not going to be a big factor?
That's exactly what I think is happening. I think this is an unusual election in the sense that that the electorate is incredibly polarized between left and right, that you have much fewer undecided voters than you've had in the past. So I don't think you'll see a big bounce out of tonight or a big bounce for Obama out of his speech. You know, very polarized electorate and very divided, which means that you need to get your supporters out. And that's why I think that Romney is taking this approach to try to mobilize his base. Again, I think his problem might be that there's just not enough of those people out there.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Tampa, Florida, Michael Cohen.
Always a pleasure, Ian. Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, a fellow at the Century Foundation, who is currently covering the Republican National Convention in Tampa for the UK Guardian and The Observer. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Tom Rosensteel, the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
And every time you move your mouth, yeah, oh, and every time you move your teeth, you need it, babe. It's a wonder that you still know how to breathe.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other, like you would to a sister or a brother? Cut this cosmopolitan style.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tom Rosensteel, the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He has been a journalist for more than three decades, both as a media critic for the Los Angeles Times and as chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He was also co-founder of the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and he and his colleague Bill Kovach have co-written Warp Speed, America in the Age of Mixed Media, The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect, and most recently, Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Rosensteel.
Thank you.
And in terms of the title of your last book, Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload, it seems that there's a overload. The wires are jammed now with reviews of Paul Ryan's speech from the Republican convention last night. And the preponderance of reviews, I don't think, are particularly good. But there's a sense that the fact checkers are working overtime here. What is this a case of the barn door open and the horses down the paddock, and the initial message that gets out is stronger than the subsequent messages attempting to correct the record?
Well, I think this is a fascinating question that is altered by the digital age. There's a quote from Edward R. Murrow from the 1950s that I think may have actually been attributed to Mark Twain in the 19th century first, which is that a lie can get around the world before the truth can get its pants on. I was on Twitter during Ryan's speech, and the first account that I saw questioning some of the assertions in his speech came literally within minutes. I was watching the speech in real time, and moments after certain assertions were made, there were tweets challenging or actually providing evidence repudiating some of the statements. I think we need to sort of see a sorting out process over a few days that it also includes some opinion surveys to see whether or not the consensus is that Ryan's speech contained a lot of inaccuracies, or whether this speech was a success, or whether we are in some environment now where there's a blue truth and a red truth. I'm not overly nostalgic about some golden age of accuracy. And certainly I can cite you many examples from politics a generation ago or longer of politicians using lies and misdirection. So the question is whether or not there's a greater scale of that now, and whether the volume of information back and forth makes some devaluation of truth on some level.
So in terms of the role of a journalist, particularly those that were anchoring the coverage of Ryan's speech last night, when the speech is over and you have pictures of a rapt audience just enthralled by this, you know, some people call him the GOP's Wonder Boy, I guess the journalists who are on must feel it's a little bit of a challenge to say, that was just a pack of lies, because they're going to come across as spoil sports. What kind of restraints are on them in terms of their ability to report honestly about their feelings, or do they have to sort of mediate and moderate their opinions based upon what they're covering, which is a convention full of partisans?
Well, I think that the television people have always been somewhat constrained, both by speed and by good manners. It is different to be at someone's event and to be in the hall and to be amid the cheering. You're also on instantaneously. You may even have been situated on the floor or in a booth, where your ability to do fact-checking may be a little more limited. And
in the modern context of television, particularly broadcast, you're only on for a few moments before you're off the air, because the parties have literally packed that hour so that the TV people don't have a lot of time to provide analysis. Most of the analysis I saw from television people was fairly, I would say, sort of performance-based. It did I think it was good speech, well delivered? So the fact-checking, to the extent that we see it, is now coming from different venues. There's a handful of institutions that are dedicated to fact-checking, like PolitiFact, which is part of the Tampa Times newspaper. There is factcheck.org, which is part of the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. The Washington Post has a fact-checking operation. But these tend to be more text-based. They're not television-oriented. CNN at one time did have a fact-checking unit. That was run by Brooks Jackson, who now does factcheck.org at the University of Pennsylvania.
Again, I'm speaking with Tom Rosenstiel, who's the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He's been a journalist for more than three decades, both as a media critic for the Los Angeles Times and as chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He also co-founded the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and his most recent book is Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. Well, we know that there's a fairly concrete and deeply held belief amongst conservatives in this country that there's such a thing as a liberal media. And I'm talking to you from the Pacifica Station in Los Angeles, which is about as far left as you get. And I'm very skeptical of the very notion of a liberal media because Pacifica's voice is so small and muted to some extent by its own internal fratricide. But the long and the short of it is it strikes me as a well-worn canard that there is this great sort of liberal media. But it's a deeply heartfelt belief, particularly amongst Tea Party type people. So again, I would think that would be a restraining factor, wouldn't it? That the so-called mainstream media, or as the lamestream media, as Sarah Palin likes to call it, how much are they restrained from appearing to be liberal because of this charge?
Yeah, well, there's certainly some element of what some people have called working the refs, complaining about the about bias in the media as a way of intimidating journalists from being critical, and that much of this certainly over time has traditionally been coming from the conservative side. What's interesting when you look at the survey data is that in the 90s and early part of this decade, it was conservatives who said that they thought the media was not to be trusted. In the last few years, the last three or four, in our survey data at the Pew Research Center, it's liberals who increasingly believe that the press is biased, and they're being influenced by the rise of a conservative press, which has gained force and gained audience on cable and radio and some other venues. I think the real question is sort of if there's been an attack on the truth squatters in the last 24 hours for attacking or criticizing Ryan's speech, are we in some sort of post-factual era? This is a new narrative that I've been hearing today, and I've certainly heard it before. I'm not sure that if you attack the press that you're trying to delegitimize it for all time, because the same critics who will attack the press when it's convenient to do so, I find often will enlist their support when it also serves their purposes. This is political behavior by partisans. My sense is that when you attack the people who say that you've been inaccurate or false in your claims as a political actor, what you're really trying to do is engender doubt you're not making a systemic claim about fact-checking for all time. You're saying, in this case, I'm gonna deny what you're saying, and people who are inclined to believe me won't be sure who to believe. It's a bit like in a lawsuit when one side has expert witnesses that denounce or counterclaim the expert witnesses on the other side. In the end, juries discount the expert witnesses because they disagree.
So, again, Tom Rosenstiel, the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He's been a journalist for more than three decades, both as a media critic for the Los Angeles Times and as chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He also co-founded the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and his latest book is Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. There's also, before Paul Ryan's speech last night, there'd been a lot of complaints from the White House and from Democrats about the advertising campaign that Mitt Romney's been running. In fact, going back to his first TV commercial back when he was running in Iowa in the primaries, his first commercial essentially put John McCain's words in Barack Obama's mouth. The welfare waiver commercial has really got the White House fuming and had Bill Clinton try to refute the record. But a pollster for Romney, Neil Newhouse, has defended this, what the White House considers demonstrably false advertisements, saying, we're not going to let our campaign be dictated by fact checkers. So is this just, you know, the idea that in politics it's a plague on both the houses, that the public tunes out, that once you make it a partisan to and fro, everybody's eyes glaze over?
Well, this is not a new tactic. I mean, fact-checking may be new. It can date it back to in the press to about 1990, and it's grown. Certainly it's grown in the last 10 years as the press no longer a sole gatekeeper over what the public knows, searches for trying to identify its value. And one of the things that journalists in the reportorial media believe is that their value is in helping authenticate for people what facts are true, what things they can believe, and which things they should see as untrue. But the idea that politicians traffic in untruth is in no way a recent phenomenon or a digital phenomenon. You can go back to Thomas Jefferson hiring slanderous journalists to attack Alexander Hamilton, although such an ancient example, I think, is too quaint. But certainly Lyndon Johnson famously attacked his first Senate rival, and when one of his aides said, it's not true, he said, yeah, I just want to hear the SOB deny it. White House or aides to Richard Nixon in the selling of the president 1968, talking about ideas no longer matter in politics, only image. Or during the Clinton years, people talking about perception is reality in Washington, or during the Bush year is a quote in a famous New York Times magazine piece anonymously saying that we're moving past the reality-based or fact-based media. It is in the interest of political consultants to claim to their clients and to the media that they can bend reality. I don't think they know whether they can or not. Michael Beaver famously claimed that the words on television no longer mattered if people saw the images that the White House constructed. It was only the images that mattered. In fact, social science shows that's not true, that when the words and the images conflict, the audience doesn't receive any messages. There's a dissonance, and it sort of doesn't register on the brain. So the charlatans, not the charlatans, but the Svengalis of politics always claim that their power is great. I don't know that human nature has changed that much over the years.
Well, just in the last minute, Tom Rosenthal, why not have a kind of ombudsman for the truth? You know, I mean, obviously the media has changed. You mentioned Lyndon Johnson. When Walter Cronkite turned against the Vietnam War, Johnson apparently said, "We've just lost the war." Such was Cronkite's credibility. Those days are over, clearly. Is it feasible to have an ombudsman for the truth?
Well, you know, the digital utopians would say we have that now, and it's the crowd, that our chances of getting at the truth is greater than it's ever been because we have so many sources. And it is true that you can, depending on who you follow on Twitter and social media, you can see, very quickly when things are called out. I think consensus is harder. You mentioned Cronkite, who in 1968, after the Tet Offensive, famously came back from Vietnam and said the war can't be won. And as you say, Johnson thought, well, then I've lost the country if I've lost Cronkite. But that was probably a rare moment of a high watermark for the press, perceived as an arbiter. If you go back to pre-World War II, when you had multiple papers in every city, and papers tended to be partisan, there was a kind of fractious media debate the papers in Chicago couldn't even agree on how to spell words because the Chicago Tribune decided it was going to simplify the English language. There was a moment of a kind of homogenized media consensus and a high degree, incidentally, of trust in the press at that moment. I don't think that's coming back, and I think that we're going to slog over what's true and what's not in a way that we probably also did during the McCarthy age, during the 30s, during the 19th century. I mean, it's a very polarized moment in American politics. The media, I think, culture is abetting that polarization, but that's not the first time it's happened. I'm not excusing it, and I'm not happy about it, but we've seen this mess before.
Well, Tom Rosenthal, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I mean, speaking with Tom Rosenthal, who's the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He's been a journalist for more than 3 decades, both as a media critic for the Los Angeles Times and as chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He is also the co-founder of the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and with his colleague Bill Kovach has co-written Warp Speed, America in the Age of Mixed Media, The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know, and the Public Should Expect, and most recently, Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the $6 billion 2012 elections.
It's the money.
All that diamond dust, blowing up your hopes, flamboyant obstacles, deals made to cope, ideas in decline, rise of the lost, yeah, hey. Here we stand, slave to networks, master plans, swags the brand, open a can. Chains off still, y'all never ran, but who do you think you are?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Franz, a professor in the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He is currently co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads in top races across the country. His books include Campaign Advertising in American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Franz.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And my understanding from a BBC article I read recently that you were quoted in is that this is going to be a $6 billion election. Is that?
Yeah. Well, it has the potential to be yes, one of the most expensive, probably the most expensive electoral cycle in American history.
And how's that figure calculated? Because I guess we don't really quite know about how much money's really being spent, because there's no real obligation on the part of a lot of the big super PAC donors, particularly some of the billionaires, to reveal who they are because of this 501c4 fiction to do with what, some sort of charitable giving. Isn't that the rubric under which it operates?
Yes, yes. Many of these new interest groups that are advertising in campaigns are registered as sort of nonprofit social welfare groups that don't show up in sort of Federal Election Commission reports. One of the ways that we can calculate their spending is through the project that I'm affiliated with, the Wesleyan Media Project. We can just capture ads that that mention candidates, feature candidates in their ads, and then we know how often those ads air, and then we can use that to kind of come up with an estimate of how much was spent by these groups, regardless of whether they register with the commission. So we do have some handle on how much is being spent on TV, but of course there's other ways that these groups can spend money in campaigns that isn't as easily or systematically tracked, such as sort of mobilizing voters off the air and so forth.
So the $6 billion figure, of course, is more than the annual GDP of a lot of third world countries. It's a disturbing amount of money. And as you've just mentioned, Michael Franz, most of it goes to the media monopolies.
Yes. I mean, the majority of a candidate's budget in a competitive House or Senate race, in most cases, would go to funding television advertising. And that also is increasingly including costs for social media advertising, social media outreach, ads on YouTube, ads on Facebook, and so forth, which are cheaper but are also kind of adding to the candidate's budget, because we're not seeing a decline in TV ads in terms of how many are being aired. We're seeing an increase, and so as candidates are spending more money on TV ads and they're also spending more money on new media, the cost of campaigns is consequently rising, and the major beneficiaries of this oftentimes are TV stations who just reap, basically rake the money in a competitive state when two candidates are fighting each other back and forth.
So one would assume then that the media monopolies have little to no interest in reforming a political process that rewards them so handsomely.
No, very, very little. I mean, if you were to imagine, and some reformers have pushed this over the years, free advertising for candidates and so forth, under the presumption that the government owns the airwaves, especially broadcast stations. You know, there would be a huge, huge pushback from the broadcasting industry in terms of fighting that kind of grab from the government, because it would be perceived as a major loss of revenue for these stations. And so, yes, I mean, there's very little chance that we'd see any reform in that nature, given the financial interests that TV stations have in keeping campaigns costly.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Franz, who's a professor in the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He is currently co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads in top races across the country. And his books include Campaign Advertising in American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. So according to Michael Toner, the former chair of the U.S. Federal Elections Commission, as far as he's concerned, the sky's the limit in terms of price tags. He thinks that you can't spend too much and sees the enormous amounts of spending that's going on as a good thing, that it engages voters and makes them more likely to turn out. Do you share that notion?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the notion. I think that what ends up happening oftentimes when campaigns don't outreach as much to voters, perhaps if campaigns there were a cap on how much candidates could spend and so forth, would be that voters would oftentimes rely on other factors to make their decisions, such as party identification or, you know, what friends and family had urged them to do, as opposed to making their own independent judgment, which could come from being exposed to a campaign. And being exposed to a campaign means the campaign needs to be out there spending money. What we don't necessarily, or what I might necessarily split from the conventional wisdom on that issue, is that sort of raw dollar value, more is better, doesn't take into account oftentimes the different content of campaigns that can come with spending a lot of money. So super PACs are going to spend a lot of money, but that's not necessarily more is better, because they're going to be spending a lot of money on pretty nasty, negative, mudslinging campaign ads. And that may not be the best kind of discourse that we hope for. And so, you know, whereas campaigning is definitely useful for people, it's you definitely have to pay attention also to the way campaigns are waged.
So, Michael Franz, I have a problem, though, with just this disparity or this disconnect in our democracy. There are about 5 million eligible voters in America who voted before who are being denied the vote because of new laws put through by Republicans that essentially force them to jump through hoops to identify who they are. But meanwhile, a handful of billionaires who appear to be buying the election for the Republicans don't have to reveal who they are. So to me, that is just unbelievable.
Well, I mean, that's absolutely an important distinction to make, an important point to note, because, yes, you're having the sense of voters who show up at the polls being required to disclose who they are with and prove who they are, but plenty of funders of campaign ads hiding behind an assumed anonymity right that exists in the First Amendment, which it does not. There's no right to political anonymity in our democracy. So, yes, I mean, it's the same forces that are standing up urging people to show up at the polls with proof that they are who they are should be the same people who are requiring or demanding that the people who are funding these ads through these nonprofits also stand behind who they are and disclose the identity of the funders and make it as accessible to the public as possible.
So how does this compare, though, to other countries? I mean, I know how other countries operate, particularly the kind of money that's spent. In the United Kingdom, for example, a total of £31 million, that's about $50 million, was spent by all parties in the last general election in the UK 2 years ago, making U.S. spending 120 times as much and 23 times as much per person. Again, I have problems with that. I just don't understand why it is that this has to go on for so long and why it is necessary to spend this much money. And if you make our politics about money, if you make it about money, it means people with money are going to win. But if you make it about issues and candidates, at least we can have some semblance of democracy.
Well, we have a political system, or at least an electoral system, that you wouldn't really ever design from scratch. I mean, the consequences of what we have now in terms of our campaign finance laws are a patchwork of decisions and jurisprudence that has sort of made a mockery of any sort of rational system. And I think a good example of that, beyond the length of our campaign, which is extraordinarily long, our presidential elections last now for 2 years, in actuality, not only candidates who are preparing to run prior to even that, but we have a system that is now increasingly rewarding non-political parties and non-candidates, but rewarding funders of these shadowy groups. And they're not as easily held accountable by voters. We don't necessarily know who's behind them. And the political parties are being handcuffed by a set of rules that limit what they can raise and spend, just like the candidates. And they're being increasingly marginalized by these super PACs and these outside groups that have no rules that apply to them anymore. And so what that results in is a lot of political speech, but coming from a diversity of speakers that have no accountability. And I think that's not exactly an ideal political situation to have. If anything, we should, you know, and there's controversy about this proposed change, we should try to reinforce the parties in our political system to make the parties have more responsibility for political speech, marginalize the super PACs. And this would at least allow voters to have a better handle over what's coming on their television screens. If they see it coming from the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or from Republican candidates or Democratic candidates, they can more easily sort of sort that into their own predispositions. But when it's coming from the Center for American Democracy and you have no way of knowing who's behind the Center for American Democracy, that's sort of making a mockery of sort of the transparency that we'd like in our system.
So, Michael France, your books, of course, include Campaign Advertising in American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. Since you've been watching elections for some time, it seems to me that this election is, particularly on the Republican side, is so flagrantly devoid of any, it's so, I think it's deeply cynical, frankly, most of the advertising that Mitt Romney's put up, starting with the first one that he, first ad that he put out back in Iowa, where he put John McCain's words in Barack Obama's mouth. And the latest ones are the one about the welfare waivers. Everybody involved has been screaming from the rafters, including the architect of welfare reform, Bill Clinton, about how dishonest and duplicitous the ad is. It's clearly targeted at blue-collar, so-called Reagan Democrats to get them angry and make them feel that somehow Obama's, you know, giving their money away to a bunch of minority freeloaders. So we understand the motives and we understand why they're doing it, but I just don't feel that there's any mechanism in this country to call people out on this flagrant dishonesty. There are a few fact-checking organizations, but that's usually after the horse is way down the paddock and the barn door is way open.
No, you're right. I mean, the fact-checking that goes on and that is really well done is few and far between. There are, you know, in any given presidential election, you know, this year there might be 200 or 300 separate Romney ads and 200 or 300 separately crafted Obama ads, and there's no way that the fact checkers are going to check all of those. They check the highest profile ones and so forth. I think it's incumbent upon voters to take a little bit more responsibility, perhaps, in what they believe or what they accept as valuable information. I mean, sort of the boots on the ground here is the individual voter who's watching television, who sees an ad and decides whether or not they're going to accept it or not. I think what they should do is they should talk more about these ads. They should talk more about the thinking they have in the way they're going to vote and see if that can sort of help perhaps blunt sort of a simple message coming their way that then impacts their thinking on a candidate or an issue. The more we talk about these with people and the more we try to engage people who disagree with us, the more Republicans talk to Democrats and Democrats talk to Republicans, the better off we'll be in our political system. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be entirely civil all the time and we might end up having some heated conversations, but in a culture where we sort of pit religion and politics as things we should never discuss with one another, I think we end up doing ourselves an added disservice when our political system is increasingly being run by these big funders. We need to start talking more about these things and taking responsibility for the way we act politically.
Well, Michael France, if we look at what happened in the last election, if you will, in Wisconsin, the recall election, where the state was blanketed with not just TV advertising, but with also flyers in the mail and people knocking on your door, all stops were pulled out there. And the expectation is that as we get closer to November, similar activities are going to happen nationwide. There's going to be a last-minute saturation, or it's been often been referred to as carpet bombing advertising campaigns. And I'm just wondering, and in those conditions, of course, there's more money chasing airtime. That's how much the media people are sitting in the catbird seat here. What's the psychological effect of this? It seems to me that it sort of almost has a kind of Stockholm syndrome thing to it, where you just, you know, eventually just identify with your torturer just to get it over with, you know?
It's possible. I mean, I think what seems more likely is that there's declining marginal returns for most of this advertising, and so you know, you might be affected by the ads that you see, but when you've seen them 50 times, you don't listen to them anymore as much. So there is a really tricky kind of needle you try to thread in running your campaign ads, which is you don't want to go up too early and blanket the airwaves in all these places and reach that sort of plateau of decreasing effectiveness way before people end up making their decision. But you don't want to go too late with most of your advertising so that the other side has been able to define you without you being on TV. And so candidates, in the end up risking the problem of the former rather than the problem of the latter, and they end up advertising sort of continuously. But what ends up happening is voters sort of end up sort of stop listening to the ads that they see continuously, and the effect can, you know, kind of just kind of sort of plateau. But that is particularly something that isn't very harmful, perhaps, when both sides are advertising in equal amounts. You know, then it ends up sort of canceling each other out. But when one particular side has a big advantage, then they can move a number of voters in to your camp. And so what you mentioned might be possible, but only when candidates are really have sort of, or when one side has a sort of the stage to themselves.
Well, just in closing, I recently spoke with a couple of campaign professionals, one of whom ran John McCain's 2008 campaign and another ran a number of Democratic presidential and senatorial campaigns. And they both said that the depressing thing about our democracy is that most of this advertising and activity goes on only in the swing states. So most of the country doesn't even know there's an election going on.
Right.
And they pour all this money into these swing states, wall-to-wall advertising. And then in late October, they and we're talking about only less than 20% of the country, but by late October, then they started targeting the undecided. And if you are undecided in late October, you tend to be a kind of ignorant couch potato that doesn't read newspapers or know what the hell is going on. And that is the demographic that they finally target in the home stretch. So it makes you sort of depressed about the whole idea of our democracy. In the end, the swing voters are perhaps our most ignorant citizens.
Well, you know, I think the other thing, I mean, there's also a bit of a split perhaps you might have in whether or not swing voters, or let's call them undecided voters, are regular voters or not. And so an undecided voter who rarely votes or who isn't going to vote or is very unlikely to vote in a presidential election is what you more than likely describe. I have absolutely no problem being highly critical of that person's political engagement if they're not going to vote in an incredibly important presidential election. But the undecided voter in a swing state who is a regular voter is probably not the couch potato, but probably someone who may literally be conflicted over whether or not Obama or McCain in, say, 2008 was better for this country, or who might have who might like Obama but who really doesn't know if his policies have been successful. And those folks are just sort of waiting to figure out what they really want to do. And I wouldn't be as critical as them. But I really think the big problem in our political system is exactly what you described with the Electoral College, that segmented electorate that we have focusing on four or five states at the very end is a huge disservice to a national discussion that we should be having about the presidential election. I think we need a popular vote to decide our presidential elections, which would consequently force candidates to engage everywhere, because every vote would count. And I think that would just be a far, far better thing for our political system than what we have today.
Well, Michael Franz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Franz, who's a professor in the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He is currently co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads in top races across the country. His books include Campaign Advertising in American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. Bye for now.